I'm Jason Van Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed podcast. So, welcome back to Disasters Deconstructed podcast. This is week 10. And thank you all for joining us for season one so far of our new podcast. We're really excited about the amount of people that are tuning in every week. We're looking at about 300 or 400 people per week that are downloading our episodes, which is so exciting. So we'd encourage you to leave us reviews, leave us ratings on iTunes, leave us your comments on Twitter, or on the episodes. We'd love to respond to some of the comments of the community. And please, please do share the podcast with your friends and on your social media networks. That would be really helpful to spread the word about our new podcast. So we hope you enjoyed the recent episodes with JC Gaillard on capacity. That was episodes 7 and 8. And also episode 9 last week with Giuseppe Farino and Emmanuel Raju, where we talked about whether disaster studies is really radical. Now I just wanted to introduce what we have in store for you next, which is 2 weeks of a interview which we conducted with Tony Oliver Smith a while ago. Many of you will know Tony. He has been a very influential voice in disaster studies. He's an emeritus professor here at University of Florida, and I'm just privileged to live in the same city as him and to get to spend some time with him, learning and listening. And so we sat down with Tony to talk about root causes of disaster, which is something he's very passionate about. So let's get into it.
We've talked about hazards, we've talked about the capacity of communities, we've talked about human vulnerability and exposure. And today, we really want to unpack the concept, the idea that is often used to describe the underlying and sometimes unrealized causes of disasters. So today, we are going to talk about the idea of root causes.
Yeah, so to talk about this concept of root causes of disasters, I can't really imagine a more fitting guest than we have with us today. So many of us that undertake research in disaster studies have been influenced by his work, and his books and articles continue to inspire scholars around the world. So we're so privileged to be joined by Tony Oliver Smith today. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Welcome, Tony. Hello from the UK. Well, when we were just chatting, just before starting the recording, you know, you said that whilst you're retired, you seem to be quite busy. So what are you up to these days? What are you working on?
I retired from the University of Florida, but I didn't really retire. I did a 4-year stint with the United Nations University and Institute for Environment and Human Security in Bonn. And then I was working with the Integrated Research on Disaster Risk Project in Beijing. And now I'm doing actually quite a lot of work with the intersection of climate change and natural hazards, particularly as it impacts communities, uproots them and displaces them, and in some circumstances resettles them. So I'm working in Panama, and I've just finished working some in Louisiana.
Wow, amazing. So it sounds like it's been busy.
It has.
Explain some of these concepts and frameworks and theories that you've been working on over these decades to people who are outside of the field. How do you put it in normal language for people?
Well, I think that one of the major things that we have been working on for 45, 40 years is the question of the sort of natural construction of disasters, that is, that disasters are somehow or other natural events. And you know, that was the reigning paradigm or the reigning theory for a long, long time, until about 45 years ago, when disaster researchers started doing a lot of work in the developing world. Most disaster research had actually taken place in the European and North American context. And so there were several of us who were working in various areas, countries of Africa and Latin America. I was in Latin America. People like Ben Wisner and Phil O'Keefe were working in Africa. And one thing that kind of leapt to our imagination or to our realization was that the disasters that we were working with or in were so much more serious than disasters in the developed world. And so we sought we looked for a means to explain this. And so in the early 70s, you get the emergence of the idea of that somehow or other, disasters are so much worse in the developing world, but the hazards, in effect, were the hazards that we always had, and they were, so the idea of vulnerability emerged, and that is that, in effect, the disaster was not the natural hazard. The disaster took place in the society and was a function of the organization of that society. So that began a kind of paradigm shift in which we began really focusing on the organization of the society much more than on the actual expanse or intensity of the disaster, of the natural hazard itself. That, however, has been a very difficult question to address because, well, for one thing, the idea of natural disaster has become so embedded in the language. But also what it does is it changes the focus from the natural hazard. Obviously, you have to know what the intensity of the hurricane is or the intensity of the earthquake. But in effect, what becomes far more important in understanding the nature of a disaster is what are the characteristics of the society that in effect make it so vulnerable to the impact of a natural hazard. After all, a natural hazard, a hurricane over the ocean is not a disaster. An earthquake where there are no people, where there are no buildings, is simply a natural phenomenon. It becomes a hazard in the context of a society, and that hazard becomes a disaster in the context of a society. So this is the fundamental shift that took place or began about 45 years ago, but is still orienting the way research approaches the issue of disaster. The struggle that we actually have right now is embedding the shift or the focus on societies in the policy and practice world. So that in many ways that shift has taken place, but there are still people who speak about natural disasters at the highest levels of policy in governments and in international organizations.
Well, we don't want to talk about the root causes. Why so many people don't seem to understand or don't want to understand what we mean by the root causes of disaster?
Well, one of the things about the term natural disasters is that it roots the causality in nature. And when you naturalize anything, then there's nothing you can really do about it. But in effect, when you refocus or turn your view to the society, then in effect you adopt a critical perspective. Mm-hmm. And the critical perspective said, what's going on in this society that makes it so vulnerable to a natural hazard? It's a society that turns the natural hazard into a disaster. And that means that you have to adopt a self-critical perspective. And regarding how the society and the economy and the politics are structured, are organized, and who, in effect, is doing that. How are these frameworks, some institutionalized, come about that socially construct risk, that socially construct vulnerability? And when those conditions of risk and vulnerability are combined with a natural hazard, a disaster is produced. That makes some people very uncomfortable, because what it basically is saying, you need to change. And in some cases, you need to change rather radically from a structural standpoint. And that's very, very threatening to vested interests in the way the society is currently organized.
Do you think it's significant that that sort of recognition that of risk constructed by the organization of society occurred in developing countries? And it seems to me like the Western world of science is dominant, and also that this expression natural disaster is dominant, especially in a country like the US. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's significance there in terms of not recognizing the social construction of risk because for a lot of people it's not right in front of them?
Well, it is a function of, I mean, underdevelopment is a function of not only the internal workings of the society, but of the relationship of that society to a global system in which they occupy a particular status or role, which determines in many ways what their role will be in the international system. And so the whole question of rooting the idea of disasters in nature favors those relationships from the point of view of the developed world. In other words, if you can blame the disaster on underdevelopment, and then you locate the causes of underdevelopment in the nation that has suffered the disaster, then the whole workings of the international system are relieved of any responsibility in this. I mean, people today talk about an epidemic of disasters when, in effect, the disasters are a system of another kind of epidemic that is now global in the way certain political and economic relationships are organized and structured.
So I guess when we do not talk about root causes, we sort of cover vested interests of be that governmental or non-governmental organizations or any other players. But what surprises me really is why academics still don't quite want to acknowledge root causes, particularly those working in natural sciences. Very often, there is quite a big fight against or for using the phrase natural disasters. Why do you think that's the case? Why do we, as scientists, do we still struggle to accept root causes?
Well, I think in many cases, we sort of mark or carve out our turf. It's what we do. It's what we study. And there's a certain territoriality there, I think, that perhaps people in the social sciences, people in the natural sciences, tend to want to defend. But one of the things I think is really interesting, and I have a colleague who's a perfect example of this. She's a geomorphologist, but totally understands and is very adept at using social science concepts in informing the kind of research that she does on landslides. And so there has to be... the question of the natural science of hazards is not going to go away. We need to know the intensity of the of the natural hazards as they take place in time, and how they develop, how they can be predicted. These are all absolutely fundamental to the science of disaster research. I think that there are many natural scientists today who are completely comfortable with the idea of the social construction of disaster.
Right.
They recognize that the natural hazard is part of that.
Ksenia and I did some work last year on this expression. And it's really looking at the fact that many scholars that are looking at disaster risk with a vulnerability paradigm are still using the expression. And it sort of exposes this kind of contradiction in the narrative, which is very striking when you look at the collection of the body of work. Why do you think that happens? Some of the things that we were turning over in this paper were, people using it as a buzzword, people mm-hmm. using it because they're citing other literature that's using it. I mean, what do you think the main reasons are for this? And is it a problem?
Well, it is a problem. It is a problem insofar as it distracts our focus back to the hazard. The hazard is undeniably important, but it is not the cause. It may be what we could call a trigger of some sort, but it is not the cause of a disaster. And so that's going against probably a century's construction of the cause of disaster. Although Voltaire, after the earthquake in Lisbon in the 18th century, basically he nailed it. He said, "Yeah, this is." He was a very much aware of the fact that the disaster, that earthquake, had social roots. So it's not really a new idea, but it kind of, as I say, it's a, somewhat of a threatening idea. And so I think that there is a certain resistance to abandoning the idea of natural disaster. And one of it is, one of the sort of reasons is that to talk about the root causes of disaster in society, you have to develop, there's no short term for that. In other words, what we say is disasters associated with natural hazards. That's a lot. That's disaster or natural disaster is a shorthand. It's convenient. It's economical. But it elides the entire complexity of a disaster. And that's something that we have to really militate against, because disasters are incredibly complex because they combine those features of a natural hazard with the complexity of social life.
how do you think we can do that? You know, how can we change or shift the paradigm? You know, how can we change the language?
Well, what we attempted to do, what we've attempted to do, and this is only the kind of latest iteration of this effort, is to develop a framework that focuses on root causes. In other words, that it's a guide to research that we've developed that says, okay, if the causes of disaster are rooted in society, how do you go about studying that? What are the things that you have to note? How does understanding the root causes of disaster change your spatial and temporal frames of research? And in some cases, you may say, well, for example, a study I did back in the 90s, which is called the 500-year earthquake, which is kind of counterintuitive in a way. I worked in the 1970 earthquake in Peru. Up until the Haitian earthquake, it was the worst disaster in the history of the Western Hemisphere. 65,000 people got killed. And when I started my research, I still talked about natural disasters. But in the sort of mid-70s, we began to think about vulnerability. And so I asked the question to myself, why did 65,000 people die in the 1970 earthquake in Peru? And in 1989, an earthquake of some similar magnitude in Northern California killed 69. And so basically, I began to focus on why was Peru so vulnerable? And I went back to the pre-Columbian era, which deepened enormously the time depth of understanding of the root causes of that disaster. And I said that what happened in the conquest and the colony in Peru undermined a lot of the adaptations that 4,000 years of complex society in the Andes had developed to life in a highly seismic area. Mm. Were they perfectly adapted? Of course not. But in effect, they had 4,000 years of accumulated cultural knowledge produced a society that in effect could not entirely inoculate itself against disasters. But in effect, if they were a successful society, even if you talk about how do you measure success, well, their population was expanding until the conquest, after which the indigenous population of Peru, after the conquest, dropped by about 95%. So the time depth went back to the pre-Columbian in that study. And the spatial dimension embraced now the colonial system that was emerging in Europe at the time of the conquest. And the integration of Peru into an international system, which in effect laid the foundation for domination and the dismantling of the local economies for purposes not of subsistence, but of extraction. And in effect, so our spatial dimension basically broadened from the location of the disaster to include what was emerging as a global system. So the way we have to deepen and broaden our perspective makes the research far more complex and requires a much more multi or interdisciplinary perspective, because you've got to bring in economics, you have to bring in politics, you have to bring in, and not just local, but international, to actually look at the root causes of a disaster. Now, not every disaster will require that you do that. Sometimes you can restrict it to a certain local context. But for example, Haiti, I was asked to do a 500-year earthquake study of Haiti. And it was not altogether different in terms of methodology from the study I did in Peru, because the same institutional and structural frameworks were operating in Haiti as they were in Peru. They were different in the sense that the conquest in Peru did not turn the indigenous population into chattel. And in Haiti, the indigenous population died out and was replaced by slaves. So you have local differences that have to be taken into account. But the mechanisms that are operating are quite similar.
Yeah, I wonder whether you think that people now in the 21st century are willing to think about those kind of time frames when they consider the root causes of disasters, whether it's researchers now that are looking at this and thinking, well, is it really important now? Or whether it's the public, like, is the public aware that some of the systemic risk is generated over that time frame?
Well, certainly you can't undo history, but you can look at what those root causes set in motion. And what is set in motion are things that we call risk drivers or dynamic pressures. And so out of those risk, or so those root causes, there are a number of active processes that are operating in the present. And you have to realize that those risk drivers are creating conditions of vulnerability. And some of those risk drivers have their roots in the model of development that we have adopted on a global basis. When I mentioned before that people talk about an epidemic of disasters, and I think it's actually, as I said before, more an epidemic of neoliberal capitalism today that hides the causation of disaster, hides the creation of risk construction from public view. And so disasters really have to be seen almost as symptoms of a set of global forces and conditions. It's not an epidemic of disaster. Disasters are a symptom of another kind of epidemic.
Well, that was incredible so far. I hope you have all enjoyed it as much as we did. And just to remind you, that was part one of a two-part episode on root causes. So join us again next week for more of our conversation with Tony Oliver Smith. Can't wait. And in the meantime, check us out on Twitter at DisastersDecon. We're also on Instagram. And if you've missed any of our episodes, don't forget to download them and catch up on your favorite podcast app. And leave us reviews and ratings on iTunes. We would really appreciate that. So goodbye from me, Jason Von Medding. We will see you again next week. You've been listening to Disasters Deconstructed podcast. I'm Jason Von Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
See you next time.
Bye.